today we continue our discussions around the musical Hamilton, which is our one book program for the year. And we thought we would be, it would be a missed opportunity if we didn't talk about Broadway itself, right? We've talked about a lot of different themes over this year so far, history and politics and all kinds of things. Today we want to talk about the art form that the musical exists in. And even though we aren't going to, most of us won't get to see Hamilton quite yet, someday we might, and this will grow our appreciation. So to do this, we are very grateful for our faculty members here, all the way at the left, Dr. Craig Rosen, thank you for coming, Director of Academic Theater, and Tommy Hensel, who's Director of the Fine and Performing Arts Center, and I will turn over to them. Thanks, guys, for doing this.
Thanks, Troy. Thank you. So, hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. So Tommy and I today are tasked with, in an hour, discussing the history and the origins of the American musical. And we always say the American musical because really, of all theatrical art forms, it's the musical. The way that you might think of a Broadway musical, it's not the perfect word, is the truly American version. Before the musical, the way that you might think of it, we had all these other art forms. Of course, we had dance, we had music, we had dramatic literature, poetry, that came over from Europe. But it wasn't until America, around 1900 really, that the musical, the art form, the way we think of it, really came to be. You know, we think of America, there's always that old phrase that's kind of loaded as the melting pot. And the musical is kind of the melting pot of dramatic forms. Theater itself can include any art form, whether it's architecture or poetry or dance or music. It's kind of the mother art. And then the musical really is the thing that pulls it all together. In addition, probably for the first 75 years of the 20th century, all of the great, most important ones really were American, and they kind of embody American music, American politics, American pop culture, American dance over that period. You can trace really who we are as a country in lots of ways through the musical, whether we're a protest country, whether we're a patriotic country, whether we're a rock and roll country, a rap country, an opera country. So in our time here, since our focus this year is on Hamilton, we thought we'd be able to give you maybe a context for how we got where we are. Because while we talk so much about Hamilton being original and groundbreaking, it's also derivative of so many things, as all art is. I mean, no art exists in a vacuum. So we figured we'd start off, and Tommy's nice enough, to give you a little maybe background of the forerunners to musical theater, because in fact, music has always been part of the theater. Dating back to 500 BCE with the ancient Greeks, music was part of it, and it continued on in various forms. So maybe to just give you a little bit of an overview or an arc of musical theater, Tommy can help out there.
Yep, so we have a short amount of time to cover about 2,000 years of history here. So as Craig said, music was an integral part of Greek theater, and all the way through the Renaissance, even when it was controlled by the Catholic Church, there was still music involved in all of the dramatic literature of that period. It really wasn't until the 17th century when the art form of opera was created that in Italy and in France that we begin to see what eventually will become the American musical theater, because opera is an art form that is primarily focused on the music. The music is the most important thing, and it's what's called through composed. It means that the composer writes the entire score, and the story is told through song. So early operas and many operas that you still see today have no dialogue in them. It's all sung. So the song is the most important thing. So the music is the focus, but there is a story. As we move through time, of course, people will play with those kind of genres. And so with opera, probably not until the late 18th century and into the early 19th century, we start to see opera composers who, instead of writing about serious things, started to write about humorous subjects for the first time. And as they started to write about comedy, there were many composers who decided that it would probably be more interesting and they could move the story forward better if they inserted just a little bit of spoken dialogue into the opera. So they created a form called opera comique, which translates as comic opera. Now, some of them are not funny, but what that means is it's opera that's primarily like a regular opera that's sung for the most part, but has a little bit of dialogue here and there. There were some other composers that decided that that music was a little too serious, so they created a form called opera buffa in Italy and opera bouffe in France, which were sort of called laughing operas. So they were humorous, tremendously funny stories that had almost an equal part of singing and speaking in them for the first time. So we begin to see this evolution that you can tell the story mostly through the music still. The music is still the most important thing, but you can then tell some of the story by having dialogue and having people talk to each other instead of singing all the time. At the same time, those were kind of the serious art forms. We had a whole, for centuries, but especially in the 19th century, we had musical revues. We had something called vaudeville, which Craig may touch on a little bit later. There were minstrel shows, which were variety performances. So there were kind of the common art forms, the art forms that the people who didn't have a lot of money would go to see, and then the more highbrow art forms. We see in the 19th century, though, that they start to merge together. If you know anything about England, England has always distrusted France. So from the 12th century on, and since a lot of these opera forms came from France, the English were kind of unhappy that opera bouffe became so popular. And so there were composers in England who said, you know, we need to do something that's English, that's not French. And so we see the birth of Gilbert and Sullivan, who are very famous composers of what we call operetta. And an operetta is like an opera through composed. It's got music as the primary function, but it's got a lot of dialogue, and it's usually on a funny subject. And for the first time, we start to see songs that are inserted into the shows that don't have anything at all to do with the plot. They're just fun, interesting songs that people like to sing, or they're popular songs that were famous during the day that the composer just puts into the show. So for the first time, we start to see popular music sneaking into this art form. So eventually what happens is a man named George Edwards in England creates what we now call musical comedy. He took all of these art forms and he said, you know, this was really popular and this was really popular, but what would happen if I wrote a story, an original story, and had somebody compose fresh new music to it, but also threw in some popular songs so that people would hear things they already know. And because he wanted to appeal to the general public, he also threw a whole bunch of really attractive women on stage wearing not very many clothes, dancing a lot. I had fabulous sets and costumes and lights and special effects and created this giant sort of expansive thing. The plot, not so much. There's a little bit of a plot. The plot is basically there just to put all of this other entertainment together and string it together. But what has happened now is that we see the birth of what we call musical comedy. And there was a really interesting quote that I found from a theater reviewer in 1911 said this: modern audiences took to musical comedy because they found themselves, the fashions, and the idiosyncrasies of the day reflected in it. They got just enough of a story to keep their attention alert without any undue straining of the intellectual faculties. They enjoyed the most tuneful melodies of the most popular composers of the day. Droll comedians stirred them to laughter. Pretty maidens danced their way into their hearts, while scenes of unexpected splendor dazzled their vision. So that basically tells us what that art form was like. So Craig?
So, where does American musical theater begin? And of course, it's hard to ever put a finger on it, but I think most scholars sort of trace it to this one play called The Black Crook. And we're at 1866 now, so to give you a kind of a frame of reference of how far we're going back. And The Black Crook was sort of an oddity that came together. At the time, there was a very popular art form, dramatic art form called melodrama. And melodrama were these huge extravaganzas, and there'd be musical underscoring, and there'd be great spectacle and special effects, like trains going across the stage as you tied a woman to the train tracks, the damsel in distress. So you had these melodramas that were so popular, but there was one that was booked, and the producers knew it wasn't very, very good. It was called The Black Crook. And fortuitously, at that same time in New York, there was a ballet troupe from Paris that was stranded in New York. So the producers took this idea and they said, well, what if we take these beautiful women, as you said earlier, put them on the stage, put them in flesh-colored tights, which was a big deal, flesh-colored tights here on the stage, and see if that livens it up. And of course, just like today, sex sells, and it became a huge phenomenon. It became, at the time, the longest running show in Broadway history. So it kind of set the mold for what American musicals were going to be really for about 60 years, really up to Showboat. Mm-hmm. The music was not original. These were established songs, so they weren't written for the shows, but the dance and the spectacle were. And once that began, it really kind of set things into motion. It wasn't for about 20 or 30 years till we got a musical written, an American musical written with fresh song, with fresh songs for it. But so that sort of oddity that was kind of put together, this mishmash, really kind of set the stage for what was going to happen later on. And it sort of stays the same. It evolves a little bit until about the turn of the century, till around 1900, 1910, an era where musicals start getting really patriotic. George M. Cohan and a lot of these great things that, again, still are kind of superficial, but they are American. They're establishing American identities, who we are. And that's a big change. It's establishing us, not adapting other cultures into what we are. So I know Tommy is going to kind of talk about this period some.
Great. So the Black Crook was a big turning point in musical theater. And then in 1894, there was a second turning point that happened in England with a show called The Shop Girl, which I just talked about a minute ago. It was that first musical that had original music, but with some popular songs. It had dancing girls, but it had a little bit of a plot. And in America, people saw this in England and thought, this is great. Let's do this on our side of the Atlantic. And so a lot of composers, including George M. Cohan, who is often called the father of musical theater, he was kind of the first person to take this British form and bring it over to America, wrote unbelievable numbers of plays. They didn't have much of a plot, and they did try to integrate the music a little bit when they could so that the music was kind of part of the play, but still, the what's important here, unlike opera and unlike operetta, where the music is super important and the plot is secondary, these shows, the plot is really kind of important, but the music itself doesn't move the plot forward so much. You could take a song out and replace it with a different song, and it would still be the same show, essentially. So the songs were not fully integrated into the plot. So this goes on until the late 19-teens, and then there were two really major things that happened in society that created the fertile ground for what Craig is going to talk about in a minute, for the creation of the book musical, which is what we now think of as Broadway. First of all, it was World War I. At that point in history, it was the most devastating event that anyone could ever remember. No one had ever seen such destruction, such death, and it was horrible. And so in America, as a response to World War I, there were several things that happened in art. First of all, anything that was remotely German for a while was completely taboo because there was a very strong anti-German sentiment. And one of the most popular art forms all the way up through World War I was the Viennese operetta, which was this German art form. So that got thrown out the window. Second, by extension, Americans were really kind of reticent to want to do anything connected with Europe because they kind of believed that Europe got us into this mess, so anything European was also kind of taboo for America. So suddenly we have composers who are trying to figure out how do we create something that celebrates America, that celebrates who we are. So composers turned to patriotic themes, but the most common theme of these early musical comedies was what we would call the Cinderella musical. They were usually stories about some poor immigrant girl, usually an Irish immigrant girl, who is poor, but through being such a good person and being such a hard worker, she finally succeeds and makes a beautiful life for herself. So it's kind of that underdog story. You work really hard and you get everything that you want. So these stories were hugely popular, and there were a ton of them. Irene, Sally, OK. There's a ton of musicals that all follow this theme. So that was very popular. So we're celebrating the American dream. We're celebrating patriotism. And then something that also had a huge impact, which you probably wouldn't think of it, but it really does. On January 20th, 1920, something really horrible happened in the United States. They passed Prohibition. So alcohol is now completely illegal in the United States.
You think that's
horrible? I think that was horrible. Oh. It was one of the worst things that ever happened in America. we'll talk about that another day. But when Prohibition happened, all the bars in New York City closed. So the people who would normally go out and socialize with their friends in bars could no longer do that. So where did they turn? They turned to the theater. So these people would go out, but remember, there's no television, there's no radio yet. We have some silent films, but there's really no other form of entertainment. So theater is their entertainment. Musical revues, which were hugely popular. The Ziegfeld Follies opened in 1907 and ran until 1931. It was huge. So they loved these musical revues with lots of dancing girls and lots of variety entertainment. But for the theater, they would go out now in much larger quantities than before. And in fact, in the early 1920s, there were some seasons that almost 40 new musicals would open on Broadway in one season. Think about that. If you look at how many musicals are running on Broadway now, there's about maybe 10 or 15 musicals, the rest straight plays, and there's about 40, but they're not all new. There's only probably 10 or 12 new musicals a year. We're talking 40 new musicals every year, and they would sell out every seat for every performance for most of these. So now we have this fertile ground laid. We have this musical comedy that's got a certain style and a theme with certain subjects. We have music that's inserted into the shows. Some of it's composed, and some of it is just popular music that they've inserted into the show. But what's interesting is that before this, they would take popular songs and insert them into shows. But what starts to happen is now hit songs are starting to come from the musicals themselves. So we see an inversion now. Composers start to see that their songs can become famous by writing them into plays. And so that's a big shift in playwriting. And so all of this is there, and it lays the ground for the beginning of what we call the book musical.
Great. So the next one, the next big name that's kind of a watershed moment, it's called Showboat. It's 1927. I'm seeing some nods. It's one that's revived often for good reason. But Showboat by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II, who his name is going to become one of the most important names, really, in the history of the musical. They write Showboat, and Showboat becomes this watershed moment. One reason is the book, the dialogue, the music, the dance start becoming integrated into the plot. They forward the story, and they're not inserted to create pop hits. They're not inserted just to entertain. The storyline is serious. It partially deals with an interracial affair. So these things become become huge. Now, race had been part of the theater for years. The longest running play in American history through the 19th century was Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that was performed throughout the country to discuss slavery for political purposes and such. And then we've got Showboat. Tommy had quickly mentioned minstrel shows, which were parodies and horribly racist commentary and imitations of black life in America. So the black character had been represented on stage up to this time, and really in the early 19th century, around 1820s, 30s in New York, there was an all-African-American theater troupe that existed for a couple of years and starred the great Ira Aldridge. So this isn't the first time we've got characters of color on the stage, but this was a serious attempt, and it was a musical, something that was mainstream, that things were incorporated. Things aren't frivolous, and while it takes another 10 years, or 20 years, give or take, 15 years, I guess, to Oklahoma, 15 years to really make that integrated musical something that's a perfected art form, Showboat becomes that watershed. The musical doesn't have to be frivolous, doesn't have to be a comedy, it doesn't have to be sex sells. It can tell a serious story that moves us. So again, we can see how America is changing in lots of different ways, and then that itself is going to lead to the golden age of the American musical.
So one of the things that's interesting is that it wasn't like suddenly everything changed and nothing was the way it was before. The most popular composer from the late 1920s to the late 1940s on Broadway was Cole Porter, and all of Cole Porter's musicals were musical comedies. They weren't integrated book musicals. I want to write a few hit songs and throw them into a show with a sort of interesting plot and have a lot of singing and dancing, you know, something like Anything Goes, which you might be able to see a clip of. But So there were still those people that were writing traditional old school 1920s musical comedies, but at the same time there were other people who took what happened with Showboat and used that as a model. And so we start seeing really interesting shows by people like Kurt Weill and other composers that are tackling interesting subjects like psychoanalysis and racism and all sorts of other things. So there's parallel things going, and it's hard to put your finger on one thing, but really in the history of musical theater in 1943 there is another watershed moment that's even probably more important than Showboat, because it basically takes everything that went before and it doesn't erase it, but it replaces it with something different and something new, and that's what we now have as our model today.
So that play, that musical we're talking about in 1943 is Oklahoma, and one that a lot of people know, performed by schools, performed, I think, in a documentary on PBS. They said there's a performance of Oklahoma somewhere in the world every day, whether it's a professional one, a school play. It was my fifth grade school play, actually. I didn't know what was going on, but I knew I had my lines, right? which is the case. But Oklahoma is written by Rodgers and Hammerstein, the same Oscar Hammerstein II, partially responsible for Showboat, and Richard Rodgers, who had used to collaborate with someone named Lorenz Hart. So here they start collaborating for various reasons, and they adapt a book called, I think it was Green Grows the Lilacs. Yep. They adapt that into this musical Oklahoma, which is set in Oklahoma as the territory is being expanded. And of course, I say of course, there's a love story involved, and this idea of, will Oklahoma be a cowboy area? The farmers and the cowmen could be friends. And now many musicals, really with Showboat on, are based on novels that have come before it, whether it's Showboat that was based on a novel by the same name, whether it's West Side Story, whether it's Phantom of the Opera, which is an American but is more recent, whether it's Rent. Musicals are often based on previous things. They change as we get more current. But Oklahoma is this watershed moment, and it begins what we consider the golden age of the American musical. I date it, and many people date it, to around 1964 with Fiddler on the Roof. Others might date it a little earlier, maybe with Sound of Music, things like that. But for me, it's between 43 and 64. We have this golden age, and Rodgers and Hammerstein become basically the Shakespeare of the American American musical. So Oklahoma, now we have things totally integrated. We've got music, we've got dance, we've got story that are all intertwined. The dance becomes a huge deal, choreographed by Agnes DeMille, another important name in American theater, who integrates ballet into the musical. There were one or two examples previously, but in this case, there's something called the dream ballet, where the lead character has this dream and then it turns into sort of a nightmare about this relationship, these two men who are interested in her. And Agnes DeMille, according to an interview, kind of said to the writers, you know what, there's no sex in this show, and there are other ways to tell stories. And because much dance up until that point was based in tap and dance and chorus line, she integrated her version of ballet, high art, in order to tell this story of a dream, a young girl's fantasy, and then nightmare, as it were. So really, from that point to the 60s, I mean, it is the serious art form, an art form that can take on so many things, including race again. Rodgers and Hammerstein really take this on, oftentimes in subtle ways. They're subversive, they tell one story, but if you pick it apart, you listen to songs, you really delve into themes, there are more important things. There are undercurrents there. They're writing, you know, 43, we're still in World War II. But 2 years later, it's going to end, and between that and 64 with Fiddler on the Roof, right, we're in the baby boomer generation, right? That's the baby boomers. This is now a country that's starting to really find itself. Music is evolving, but in that period, we also have kind of a sweetness. And when we get to Fiddler on the Roof, of course, the world is going to change politically, socially, musically, which we'll talk about. So in this period is when we get probably the musicals you may have heard of, whether it's South Pacific or Music Man, West Side Story, King and I, Cinderella, on and on and on. These ones that have become sort of staples of community theater, of college theater, of revivals on Broadway, things that people know and appreciate. One of the things that I find today is that sometimes students or adults listen to some of these and they say, "Ugh, the music," because the music doesn't relate to them, they feel like. But we have to remember that musicals reflect the music of the time. One of the things we talk about so much with Hamilton is the integration, the full integration of rap, hip hop, other forms similar. But that's just indicative of the musical. In the 80s, which we'll talk about, or 90s, Rent starts doing that. In the 60s, Hair does that with rock and roll. So the music is reflecting a time and a taste and a style. So it can be difficult sometimes if we don't have a context to see some of these early Rodgers and Hammerstein pieces. And if we are cynical, as much of our society, especially younger society, is, so we kind of roll our eyes and say, "Oh my God, this is saccharine." But we're talking about a period there that's really crucial. I'm going to jump up to Fiddler on the Roof, and then I think, Tommy, you might want to talk about the name that kind of brings through.
Yep. And just really quickly about Oklahoma, the timing of Oklahoma was really significant, because just like what happened in World War I, when Pearl Harbor was bombed in 1941, the previous Broadway season before that happened was all pretty much light, fluffy musicals that were basically more in the musical comedy zone. The next season after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we suddenly start to see patriotic musicals again, and we see Rodgers and Hammerstein celebrating this quintessentially American moment of the Oklahoma becoming a state. So people were recapturing the sense of we need to find an American voice. We need to find a voice that celebrates us as Americans. And so I think Rodgers and Hammerstein rode in on that wave and became hugely popular because they created a new art form in some ways that was totally unique to the United States.
Right, and actually Oklahoma, it celebrates the United States not in a way that's like, "I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy." It's celebrating Oklahoma, and the legend behind it is at the beginning of the show, there's no opening chorus line with beautiful women and all these tights. There's an old lady churning butter, okay? And a cowboy sort of walking down singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," the most simplest of songs, it would seem. They never are quite as simple as we think. And when the show opened on Broadway, the critics hated it. They thought it was boring. We don't have girls. We don't have chorus numbers. It's about Oklahoma. And if you live in New York, I mean, anything that's not in New York is Hicksville, let alone Oklahoma. And the story has it that the producers gave out free tickets to soldiers that were on leave. So they're walking around New York, around Times Square, they're in their uniforms, and they give out free tickets to this new Broadway, the new Broadway show. And so the soldiers come to it, and by the end of the show, the legend is that these people were weeping in the audience, because these soldiers aren't from New York, they're from Middle America, Western America, New York also, and here they were seeing the sweetness, the embodiedness of where embodiment of where they're from. And here now, this is why they are fighting. So the cynicism kind of goes away when real people see this and it really connects to them. And then from that point forward, it became the focus of what we consider the beginning of our great time. The end of it, in my book, is called Fiddler on the Roof, one that a lot of people know, and that was my fourth grade school play. My line was, "It's a cow, it was a cow." That was my line. I repeated it twice. It was an argument with another character. But Fiddler on the Roof in 1964, right? This is a play, kind of depressing, very funny, based on earlier work. And it really focuses on two things. It focuses on a Jewish town, Anatevka, in Russia, that's being overrun and is grounded in tradition. And as this play goes on, all these Jews are forced out of their town by Russian soldiers. Now, it's very funny and very sweet in songs like "Sunrise, Sunset," the quintessential wedding song when people are walking down the aisle is played sometime. And "Matchmaker," things like that are in it. And throughout it, there's also this idea of tradition, which in the Jewish religion, like most religions, traditions are such a big deal. And the protagonist, his name is Tevye, and I mean, one of the greatest characters ever written. I mean, a role any actor wants to play, I think. And in it, his daughters keep breaking traditions. His oldest daughter wants to marry a poor Jewish tailor. And Tevye wants her to marry a wealthy older man. And, you know, it's the father that makes the choice, and he loves his daughter, but there's this tradition there. And eventually, for various reasons, he allows his daughter to marry him in this great dream sequence, things like that. Another dream ballet,
yeah,
right?
It is dream ballet.
Then he's got a second daughter who says, I'm going to marry this other man, this Jewish revolutionary. I'm going to marry him. We want your blessing. But if we don't get your blessing, I'm still going to marry him, but I want to. And the third then says, I want to marry this Russian non-Jewish soldier. And in that case, Tevye can't bend anymore. And it's very moving. It's wonderful. It's moving. But again, critics kind of saw it as depressing because the ending is people are expelled from their town, although it's very funny and lovely throughout. So that's where we kind of wrap up that period, because when we get to 64, things are happening, right? We're involved in another war. Vietnam is there. Music is changing. The Beatles are coming over.
The assassination of John F. Kennedy.
The assassination of JFK. The next generation, what we label now Generation X, our generation, is born. So we're going to see the world in a different way. Music is going to change. Politics are going to change. And so is art, of course. So we sort of take that period as really the great period of the American musical. Having said that, there's going to be a name that Tommy's going to talk about that really begins during that period, and he is still alive today, and his work is going to kind of thread the needle as we move through different musical forms in theater, different concepts of what a musical is, even when the British kind of usurp the musical for about 15 years. This one person sort of is who we carry through. So he could be fit in lots of times in this discussion, but it's certainly someone that we want to give due time to. So
I'll do the beginning and then let you do this.
Sounds great.
So we're talking about Stephen Sondheim. His first musical was West Side Story. He wrote the lyrics to West Side Story, and the music was by Leonard Bernstein. So he started with a traditional musical theater background. He studied with Oscar Hammerstein, in fact. Oscar Hammerstein, Stephen Sondheim's parents were divorced, and his mother and father were estranged. And so really, Oscar Hammerstein was kind of his surrogate father. So he learned musical theater from this guy who had been doing it since the 1920s and was an icon. So his first show was West Side Story. His next major show was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which was in the same style as an old school book musical. It was kind of the same. It was funny, and it was based on pre-existing material, in this case a Roman comedy, but still it was a traditional musical in its form. And then in 1964, he decided he was going to try something completely different, and he wrote a musical called Anyone Can Whistle, which was a total flop on Broadway. It ran for 9 performances, but what was significant about it is that it broke every rule of every musical theater tradition that he had been trained in. So what's important about that is that even though it was a failure and he didn't write anything for several years after that, it stuck in his head that he liked what he did even though it was a flop, and he was going to find a way to create his own voice by essentially breaking all the rules. So in that interim period, while he is sort of contemplating what should I do for my next project, we see a huge revolution in musical theater on Broadway with shows like the one that Craig is going to talk about now that were utterly different than anything that had come before.
So in 1967, 68, a musical Hair is produced, and that's a game changer too. So right now we're at a point that music, we've got the Beatles, we've got the Rolling Stones, we've got the Who, we've got Jimi Hendrix, right? We've had Woodstock, Summer of Love. The world is a different place. So now we have this hippie, tribal, love rock musical. And in Hair, we're dealing with a tribe of youngsters who are going to protest the war. They're hippies. You think of hippies, you think of long hair, afros, you think of all of these counterculture things. And Hair then, it changes what Broadway can be. Hair, there's an acid trip on stage where everyone drops acid and they do a song called Walking in Space. I did this show in college, I should say. You should have seen the auditions. There's a famous nude scene on stage, and inevitably when one does hair today, one of the first questions someone will ask is, are you doing the nude scene? Which we did in college. We've got the show that deals with drugs and sexuality and race again, anti-war and the draft, right? So this is now a musical for a new generation, just the way people are looking at Hamilton and saying Hamilton is a musical for a new generation. Hair is doing that. And ironically, kind of the story goes, it starts off Broadway, and it becomes so popular, moves on Broadway, and the very people that it is protesting now are the people that are gonna come see it, right? It's this big hit, and they're paying, you know, just like Dick Cheney saw Hamilton and he loved it, as I look at Troy back there. So here we've got this musical. So now everything has changed. We've got a new generation who wants to hear music, who wants to see topics that really fit into who they are in their time. So again, culture changes. It's reflected in the musical. Things like Age of Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In are two songs that you may actually know. So again, this evolution, and again, a really picture of what America is. It's wonderful. And like most musicals, I would say, the movie of it can't do it justice, right? There are movies of almost all of these, including Rent, as we get to it, things like that. And it can never do it justice. And I think Hair is really one, especially the movie that was created. So we kind of move forward, and now things start changing a little bit.
So the decade of the 1970s on Broadway really belongs to Stephen Sondheim more than to any other composer. Now, at the same time, we still have composers like Jerry Herman and other people who are writing musicals based on the Rodgers and Hammerstein style. There's still these sort of lighter topics for the most part. Some of them involve social subjects, but there's still that stream of musical theater. But Sondheim in the early 1970s, and I think his watershed show is a show called Company, that was his first show in the 1970s, completely rewrote the book on how to do musical, because he essentially threw out what he had learned he was supposed to do, and he used all of his tools that he had gathered. He was an amazing composer, an amazing lyricist, and he hired really talented people to help write the stories. But all of his stories, for the most part, were original. They weren't based on other materials. Some later on were partially, but for the most part, he wrote original work. And they didn't follow any of the forms of other musicals. And each musical that he did was different. He doesn't have a through line in his style. So if you go to see Company and Follies and A Little Night Music and Pacific Overtures and Sweeney Todd all back to back, you would really not know that they were written by the same person, because he crafts the style of his musical based on the story that he is trying to tell. So the music changes, the structure changes, everything changes. And so the reason Sondheim is so important is that people who were born in the 60s who decided they wanted to study musical theater, that's who they saw, and that's who they started to emulate. So every musical theater composer that has come since Stephen Sondheim has pulled on him as one of their primary sources. So whether you like his work or not, it has completely changed the way that all composers since him have chosen to approach their work. And that includes Lin-Manuel Miranda with Hamilton. When we get to Hamilton in a few minutes, one of the things he did is he actually consulted with a man named John Wideman, who wrote the book for two of Sondheim's musicals, and asked for his advice about how to write the book for Hamilton, because he had done similar things for Sondheim. So it's a strong through line. So in the 70s, we have Sondheim revolutionizing everything on Broadway, and he's still there, and he's writing a new musical right now, as a matter of fact. But at the same time, we have another evolution going on. We have what we would call a British invasion. And then we have also a shift to musicals that don't deal with plot as much as they deal with other forms like dance and spectacle.
Yeah, we're going to start getting into a time now where the director and choreographer are either one in the same, or it's based on the choreography. They're usually three separate things. And probably the most important musical that deals with concept and such is A Chorus Line. Probably most important because A, it became the most popular, the best-selling musical up until the 80s or 90s. And Chorus Line is about, well, dancers. And it's about this group of dancers who are auditioning for the chorus line, the background roles in a musical. And they're all standing in this famous straight line, this famous tableau. And they're each basically asked by the director, why do you want to do this? And so the premise of the show is each of them are auditioning for a show within the show. And so each character comes forward and they either have a monologue or a song or a dance. And this through line that at the end, the payoff is kind of who's going to get cast in the shows, because because the audience is connected to these characters. So we're interested in the lives of the performers. You can see how the dance would be so integrated into the musical. It's about dancers doing this. So it became crucially important and very, very, very popular. It's really wonderful, and I almost defy, because there are curmudgeons out there, I'm not a humongous musical theater fan. I like it, but there are people who have passions for it. But I've seen Chorus Line probably 3 or 4 times, all top quality productions. And the first 10 minutes, it is, I say, almost impossible to anyone who is open to sit through that first 10 minutes and kind of their jaw not drop. That opening number is just jaw-dropping to me. It's real. It's just, it shows all of the talent that's up there, I think. So through the 70s, right, we've got this, and we get things like Grease and so on and so forth, these sort of retro sweet things. And then we get to what Tommy called the British invasion. And probably from the late 70s through the 80s, these huge spectacle, glitzy musicals come over. The name we most associate with the period is Andrew Lloyd Webber. And the producer, Cameron Mackintosh. Producer is important. They learn how to sell a musical. They learn how to brand a musical. They learn how to pay for the glitz and the spectacle and produce it. So musicals, not all by Webber, but Cats people know, Les Miserables people know, Miss Saigon, Phantom of the Opera. All these musicals are during that period. And these become operettas again. They're back to sung just about all the way through. But the music is more of a pop score as you go through. Hits could come from these musicals. And I'd say another reflection of the time is we're in the Reagan 80s. We're in a time of superficiality and glitz. We're at a time that MTV is born. And I think that's an aspect that sometimes I don't hear quite as much, but though most of you don't really know of a time when MTV actually played music, there was a time, and the first musicals, the first videos that came over were inevitably British, and they were glossy groups, and they were Duran Duran and Culture Club and Flock of Seagulls, and these things, that appearance and glitz and spectacle was such a big deal. And I think the music, the stage musical reflects that. Prices of going to the theater are rising and hitting $100. And in the late 70s especially, we're really in a crisis at the end of the Carter administration. During the 80s, as things become more and more prosperous, as there's this sort of this Reagan world, I guess, these musicals become more spectacle-oriented. And it's during that period that we really kind of focus on what comes over from abroad. But since we're worried about the American musical, mm-hmm. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I'll just say that one of the things that happened because of all the spectacle musicals in the 80s is that Broadway audiences started to expect spectacle regardless of what the musical was. So that changed the game for designers. Set designers, costume designers, lighting designers became more important than ever before in theater history. So even the other things we're going to talk about today have to have a certain level of spectacle in them now, because audiences absolutely began to expect that because of these 1980s shows.
And it's funny, just that word spectacle, it's totally a side note, but when Aristotle in the 4th century BCE analyzed tragedy, and he said, what makes a great play, a great tragedy? He had 6 elements. He said plot, music, plot, character, thought, music, plot, character, thought, diction, music, spectacle. I've taught it 3 times in the past 2 weeks. And you notice music and spectacle are the last two. But now when we get to these musicals, especially these ones in the 80s, these big extravaganzas, they move up to somewhere in the first 2 or 3. The construction, the plot is probably still most important. But we have this sort of change of pace. And these spectacles, to me, they keep going and going and going. And I kind of feel like the last one that burned itself out for me was Starlight Express. Oh. Did you ever?
Yes, I saw the original Broadway production. Don't go.
It's about basically trains. So how do you tell a story about trains? Well, you put them on rollerblades, and they roll through the entire show.
I have to say, it was kind of scary to watch the people roller skating over your head through the audience, which is what they did in this theater. That was kind of fun, but that was the only fun part of that show.
I feel like it implodes at that point. Yeah, but of course, we all have our preferences and taste. You know, taste is taste. So in the mid-1990s, we get the next breakthrough, I think. The one that really we associate with the next generation. We've moved, I think, from Generation X to the Millennials, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And it's an American musical called Rent. Again, one a lot of students know. Rent brings things back to America. It's set in New York. The music is a pop rock score. It's based on an opera, and again, it's an operetta. And in this case now, we've got a new generation dealing with new issues. In it, we have a very hard-hitting look at drugs. We look at AIDS. We look at it through the lens of sexuality, through drug use. You know, when we deal with hair and we deal with drugs, there's this celebratory freedom of that acid trip. Here, we're dealing with heroin, and people are getting AIDS from it. The world has changed. So here we are, sort of. Sometimes people will kind of group it in and say a hair for a new generation. Again, these big labels are difficult to either validate or not. But a musical for the next generation, for younger people, with music of younger people, about topics that younger people have to deal with at the time. And that, in addition to, I think, bringing the noise, bringing the funk, which is something, which is mainly a dance show dealing with the African American really experience in the 20th century, really ground the work back in America, and really kind of bring us to a pretty contemporary time. And over the next period, we'll say up until Hamilton, we start getting these aspects.
Yeah, so strangely enough, I would love to go back and figure out if we could figure out how it actually happened on Broadway, but starting in the mid-1990s, probably the late 1990s, we had the first one of those Disney movies that was made into a musical. I think probably Beauty and the Beast was the first one that hit, and I did a production of that once. It's actually kind of fun to perform in that show. But anyway, it ran for over 11 years on Broadway in its first run. It started a trend, so it's what many of us call the Disneyfication of Broadway. So after the success of that show, suddenly Disney went, well, hello, we have all these other shows, movies that we could turn into plays too and make a whole lot of money. So you see Pocahontas and you see The Little Mermaid and you see everything else you can possibly imagine. And other people took that same concept and started adapting existing movies and existing material. So one of the things that Disneyfication of Broadway caused is it caused a lot of artists to stop thinking about creating new work and instead started them thinking about how do we adapt something that was already successful in maybe another genre like a movie or a television show, how do we adapt that and put it onto the stage? So it's a whole different style of creation.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, first, musicals are based on books and pre-existing things. Then movies become popular, and they start doing movie musicals of West Side Story. A lot of people have seen in Sound of Music and Oklahoma and all of these things. Now things are flipped again, and now the musicals are beginning to be based on movies. And sometimes they're based on movies that were originally musicals, right? They translate. But in this Disneyfication, two other things happen. One is we start taking movies that weren't originally musicals, and we turn those into musicals. So we have Legally Blonde, the musical, for instance. So now, so much of a big deal for lots of things are name recognition. So I'm going to Broadway. I'm spending $200 to see a show. Maybe I want to see a revival that I'm familiar with. Maybe I want to see a stage version of a movie. The other part of the Disneyfication is what happened to Times Square. When I was young and I would go to New York, I'm from Philadelphia, it's 90 miles away, We would go up there, and it was seedy. I mean, you'd walk around Times Square, and there'd be, you know, there'd be homeless people and drug addicts out there. There were porn houses all over, and you would see a you would see live theater. You know, there'd be West Side Story, and then I don't know, Debbie Does Dallas.
Yeah,
I don't know why I looked at Tommy for that, but
well,
I'm just looking
there
for I'm looking for affirmation.
No, but when I first went to New York, it was still like that. So,
and then Disney wants to come in, and they say, well, if we're going to come in and spend all of this money, Times Square area has to be cleaned up. So suddenly Times Square becomes almost like a theme park. It becomes so clean and bright and glitzy, and all these porn houses and things are closed down. People are relocated or kicked out of there. So Times Square now, and which is the center part of the Broadway, of the Broadway district, of course, takes on a whole new personality, becomes family friendly, things like that. So Disney, you know, impacts it both artistically but also culturally about what New York is. So, and then with those movie adaptations, maybe we get something like The Producers, which was a Mel Brooks movie that had some musical numbers in it. Then it's made into a musical for stage where more musical numbers are adapted. And what do? Then you make a movie of the musical, which was based on a movie.
Yes.
Right? Same thing with Hairspray.
Yep.
Right? So you, now you're really going in a cycle of how to make money, or less cynically, how to share the art. Maybe I'll do it that way.
I kind of think you were right the first time, though. It's all about making money. And actually, the other trend that created was what we call jukebox musicals. Musicals that are based on usually pre-existing music, like Mamma Mia, based on the music of ABBA, or Motown, the musical, or Jersey Boys. All of these kind of things that are musicals that have tenuous plots, usually, because they're stringing together songs from either a band or a certain singer, into a loose story to celebrate that music, but really they don't have a great deal of redeeming value as far as like being great drama. They're just a lot of fun. So they're there to make money and to make people feel good.
And there had been, of course, things called like the rock opera, The Who's Tommy, which was a movie, and then it was put on Broadway, and depending on your point of view of it, put on Broadway 20 years later, 30 years later, in a way that a lot of people find more homogenized, depending on your point of view.
Oh, and Jesus Christ Superstar, too.
Jesus Christ Superstar. And then Green Day, American Idiot. We'll take that concept and we'll put that on stage and make a musical out of it. So now it's, okay, how are we going to appeal to people? Well, there are movies that they know, there are adaptations that they know, and now there's music that they know. Because at least if I go see Mamma Mia, I can sing every song. Right, I mean that's a lot of fun. I can go to American Idiot and sing every song if I know the album. So there's something about familiarity that that kind of takes over much of Broadway, but clearly not all, because we're going to move into other things like Avenue Q, let's say. For those of you who don't know, which is kind of like a cross between South Park and Sesame Street, which is puppets and real people dealing with modern day issues. I'm just looking at the time, unfortunately. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God. Book of Mormon, which is literally South Park character, South Park writers bringing things on to the stage. So You're in Town. So we do keep getting these edgier things, but they're going to become more and more not rare, but uncommon, because building a Broadway show is a huge endeavor. And as we know with the Spider-Man musical, someone's looking at me like, yes, there's a musical of Spider-Man. It was co-written the music by Bono and the Edge of U2. The director and book writer at first was Julie Taymor, who worked on stage most famously with Lion King, also movies. And there were accidents. I mean, Spider-Man has to fly, but if you don't know how to make him fly properly, he's going to fall onto the orchestra, let's say. So, and it's going to cost over $60 million to create this. So there's a whole legend behind that. I wasn't really thinking about getting there, but I went there. And things like Wicked, of course, which becomes a huge spectacle again. It's a very old-fashioned book musical, but based on pre-existing sources. People know Wizard of Oz, so they have a connection to this. Just like people know Sesame Street, they've got a connection to Avenue Q. There's something about a familiarity that they're trying to make, which is creating, inspiring some great art. Lion King is great art. I'd say Book of Mormon is. Most of these things are. But there's also that commercial element. And I think that ultimately brings us to today.
To Hamilton, yeah. Because if you think about everything that we've just said, what does Hamilton have that people are saying, oh, this is groundbreaking? Well, it's the use of contemporary music. Well, that's been happening for 200 years. So that's not new. You know, it's, you know, the story. Well, the story is a historical story. It's not anything new. So it's based on pre-existing material. They've been doing that for thousands of years as well. So all the elements that he brings together in that show are not new elements. What's new is how he puts them together and the result of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because our job nor our philosophy is not to minimize the importance or the groundbreakingness of Hamilton at all. It's just putting it in a context. You can see so much of its roots in things like Les Miserables. I said a couple months ago in the Rocky story. Everyone likes a Rocky story, an underdog that makes it to the top, so on and so forth. But you know, the telling of history then through history now, that quote, that famous description, I think is probably the most important part of it. The probably best known musical before this about American history is 1776. And that's people walking around in, you know, in their periwigs, walking around talking like they're British, you know, talking like they're British or early American. And it's not really a view of the world today.
No, and it's also a romanticized version of what it was like. What they've done in Hamilton is they've stripped away all the romanticism and made these people real, like real people with real problems who make really stupid decisions and how they have to deal with those stupid decisions and what happens. So they don't romanticize it. They actually keep it kind of gritty.
Yeah, it's not trivialized in any way. And that, I think, is the, you know, is that big difference. So, I think we made it in 1 hour, about
2,000 years of history.
Yes. Do you guys just have any questions or any points you want to kind of throw out there before we run? Yeah.
So ask the question again on the microphone.
You were saying something about musicals already being movies and then becoming musicals on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what is The Color Purple considered?
Well, it was a novel first, right? So it was a novel that was then adapted for the screen,
mm-hmm.
and then adapted for the stage and musical form. You know, when you have something like that, the person who creates, let's say, the third form, the musical, they kind of have to make a choice. Am I adapting my reading and understanding of the novel, which may or may not be what was in that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing that, or am I adapting the movie, which more people may actually know, to put it on there? And that's an issue or question an adapter, a translator has to come to. And I have to be honest, I don't know the three of them well enough to give you that answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if you have read and seen all three. You might be able to. You'll be able to answer better than me. I don't know.
Yep. No. And I've not read the book. I've only seen the movie, and I've seen the musical. So I don't know how the musical attaches to the book.
Which is having a revival on Broadway right now. Yep. The musical, and it's supposed to be unbelievable. Any other questions? Yeah, Elizabeth.
Wait. What about musicals that were originally plays? I know Fiddler on the Roof was originally a play, and Hello Dolly was originally a play called The Matchmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's the same kind of concept as, you know, you've got the original play, whatever the original source material is, and then you have to make choices as an adapter. Like, I can't just put music to this because that's not going to work, because there's got to be a change. So you have to figure out what to keep, what to change, and how the songs will move the story forward. So you may have to take parts of the story and create a song that covers, like, one whole scene in a song. So you have to actually sort of take the play apart and then figure out how can I hit all the major pieces and be true to the musical genre and make it interesting, and make people want to go see it, but at the same time still tell the story.
And who's doing the adaptation? You know, in my class, I know you guys are all thrilled, we just read the play version of Mice and Men. Well, the person who adapted it was the writer, right?
Was Steinbeck. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we can kind of see that and know this is what the playwright, how he wanted to adapt, how he envisioned that original book and what he crystallized as the key elements. Mm-hmm. If someone else is doing that adaptation, well, they're now deciphering in a different way. So again, I think a lot of it depends on who's adapting it and why they're adapting it, what point they want to make with it. It's great questions, guys. Any other stuff?
More questions?
Can I ask one?
Sure.
So in Hamilton, Miranda makes a conscious decision to cast all the parts with people of color. Mm-hmm. And I've heard you acknowledge through the history some of the commentary that musical theater has had on race relations, et cetera, throughout. That identity exploration that Miranda has done, mm-hmm. does that connect in any other ways, or is that unique with Hamilton, or is that a continuation of other ideas?
Well, I know what I think. I think it's, in some ways, it is unique to him, because I think the impulse behind it is a unique impulse. There's a difference between what in the past we've called colorblind casting in the theater, where you cast the best person for the role regardless of what their race or ethnicity is, because your goal is to get the best actor. What he has done is intentionally cast actors of color in different roles in order to insert them into the narrative that they were excluded from to begin with. So what I mean by that is back in the day of Alexander Hamilton, people of color had no voice in the decisions that were going on around them that affected them. So he's cast people of many different races in here to sort of show to make a point about them being part of that historical narrative and needing to have a voice in that narrative. And I think for me, that's different than what other people have done in their approach. I don't know how Craig feels.
Well, yeah, and you know, and clearly, right, he's commenting on America today, right? As much as back then. He's not, I think, trying to give us a historical documentary of what went on. That's clearly not what he is trying to do, but he's trying to truthfully represent the past. Early ones that dealt with race, let's say Porgy and Bess or Showboat, to begin with, they're written usually by white established writers, often white Jewish writers, actually, yeah. The earlier ones, who are writing about and with best intentions. But it's not until we, you know, move on, and then we go through the jazz period, and Langston Hughes writes plays, actually, that we start getting the voice of the people that are writing about it. And then we get Miranda, whose voice is, in our world, a multicultural voice, not just one. You know, and you may have done this research better than I, more than me, but I'm curious, as the show continues on Broadway, and I feel dumb because the answer might be right out there. We talk about colorblind casting, but is Hamilton always going to be played by an actor of Puerto Rican heritage or Hispanic heritage, or can Hamilton be played by someone of Asian heritage or African American heritage? How specific those are going to be as we move forward? And again, I don't know, you may have that answer.
Well, and I know there's been conversations, like with the Philadelphia casting, of even having Hamilton be a woman, like mm-hmm. to play with what are those roles and mm-hmm. who gets to fill those roles, which is interesting.
So that would open it up for when we want to do it here.
I think it's safe to say that he's probably not going to let, you know, an established white actor play that role. I think he's making some points with his choice of casting.
Right. No George Clooney.
No George Clooney playing Hamilton. No, not going to happen.
So...
good. Are there other questions? How about a round of applause? Thank you, guys.